And welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining me as per usual. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, pleasure to be here. I'm Jenny Gamble. I'm Professor Emeritus at Griffith University and Professor and Clinical Chair at Coventry University in a joint position with University Hospitals of Coventry and Warwickshire. Yeah, in the UK. I started in late August.
So then let's take you back then to the beginning of your career. So what kind of got you into midwifery in the first place?
Yeah, that's a bit of a long journey, Liz. Let's see if I can give you the shortened version. So I grew up in Adelaide, did my nursing training at Royal Adelaide, worked there for a year after registering as a nurse, and then went and worked as a remote area nurse, not a midwife, in the Kimberley on a community called Bidjedanga Community in northwest Western Australia. Amazing, blew my mind on many levels. And for most of that time, I was the only Western health service person there on a large community with a lot of people coming and going. And it was an ex-mission, but I wasn't a midwife. The person who was a midwife and child health nurse had left a few months after I started. She'd already been there for a good stint. And so it became very clear for the sort of 15 or 18 months I was there that I really needed to do midwifery. I loved working there. So I travelled Australia, travelled the world, ended up in Scotland and did my midwifery because I wanted to go and work back in a remote area community again, and I needed midwifery. Not really for any highfalutin reason other than that.
But so Edinburgh had that really strong reputation for midwifery back then too, didn't it?
Yeah, and I did my midwifery at the Simpson Memorial Maternity Pavilion in Edinburgh. And it did have a very auspicious name for a range of reasons, particularly obstetrics, I think, but also midwifery. But in fact, it was highly medicalized. We had Cardiff pumps and intrauterine pressure devices, and everybody lay on their back, and all primates got an episiotomy. So it was very highly medicalized. But midwives then, in some ways more than now, had a very, very strong sense of identity as midwives. And as caregivers in their own right, primary caregivers as in their own right, and community was amazing. So, yeah, it was good. But it was an 18-month program, so that it was fairly new at that stage to do an 18-month program for nurses to become midwives. And, I certainly felt like I knew how to be a certain type of midwife. And I had to learn the other types of being a midwife afterwards.
So where? How did you learn that? What did you do after Scotland?
I came back to Australia. My sister was in Brisbane, so I married a Scot, came back to Australia, and got a job at the Mater Mothers Hospital. That had a large private component to the Mater Mothers, private and public, private obstetrics. And it was a bit of a culture shock for me in terms of how obstetric-led they were. And how little strength of identity they had as midwives. But I was also becoming increasingly frustrated and aware that women needed and deserved better care, greater choice, more. And even though the word wasn't in vogue then, or wasn't conceptually a thing, they needed continuity in relationship. So I worked there for a number of years, lay ward midwife, and initially I was really happy with the idea that I was super efficient. I could get the mum and baby back down to the ward an hour after birth, having breastfed. I was efficient labour ward midwife. I just became increasingly aware. I probably started studying then, did a diploma in something or other. Maybe not, can't remember. Anyway, I became increasingly dissatisfied with, I guess, obstetric-led, medicalised care that really ran roughshod over what this could actually be in terms of a life experience that was health-enhancing, not just something women and babies survived. So I left the Mater Mothers and started up private midwifery practice. And did that for 10 years. So Brisbane Independent Midwives, I ran that for 10 years. And that was amazing. We worked effectively as a group practice. We were the first midwives in Queensland to have visiting rights to a Queensland hospital. We had visiting rights to the Mater Mothers Hospital. And we kept the visiting rights for about, I don't know, again, 15 months till the private obstetricians kicked up a fuss. And we lost backup support from the few that were providing it. And so we had an interim arrangement, but basically the visiting rights side of things ceased, but we continued to run a home birth practice. I continued to lead a home birth practice for the rest of that decade. So Jenny Fenwick worked with me then. Many of your listeners will know Professor Jen Fenwick, a long-term friend, but she was also my initial partner in that practice before she trotted off to move back to New South Wales. So, yeah, great time. So it really was all born from that essential dissatisfaction with the quality of care that women and babies were being provided and that notion of what that existential experience that was being, they were being robbed of in this machinery of institutionalised care.
So by running a business, you would have to have kept statistics for your own businesses to be able to show, justify your kind of existence really to the medical staff and to funding. So is that what got you into formal research?
No, but I recently, for the move to the UK, had to clean out all my records and finally make decisions about keep and chuck. And
big decision.
I know. And all the women had a full copy, the full original copy, in fact, of their own notes, their own health records. So I kept some samples, really, and built a bonfire on my sister's farm and burnt the rest because I didn't even feel trustworthy of a confidential disposal service. So, but in there was all the stats. You know, we had a 7% section rate, 11% transfer rate, stats over the entire time of the practice for all of us, you know, for any midwife and therefore any woman. So that was pretty impressive, and it was a really great trip down memory lane. So, yeah, we kept all the stats and that, but that's not what got me into research. What I was interested in and why I kept all that primarily is because I'm interested in accountability. I think it's such a transparency and accountability is such key concepts in the provision of healthcare. And if you're talking to a woman who's going to pay you to come, you know, for her, you to be her midwife, then she needs to understand not just the process of care that you'll provide, but what the outcomes of your care look like, have looked like, you know. So the numbers are always relatively small. You know, they're never going to pick up the big ticket items that you need huge numbers for, like maternal mortality. Of course, we didn't have any mothers die, but they're still worth reporting, you know, average birth weight, average gestation, you know, all of that data is worthy of reporting and, most importantly, worthy of collecting and making transparently available to relevant parties, including, of course, women.
And I think that's been some of the interesting discussions that I've been hearing, especially the last 12 months, of not only doing this podcast but also kind of engaging a little bit more, I suppose, in some of the international things, is are we using the right kind of right statistics in putting our arguments forward? Because it always comes down to death rate, which is, yes, very important, is very critical, but there are so many other measures that we could be using but we don't use. So, I mean, is this going to be, do you think this could be the change in the future in how we measure and how we actually compare services?
I think that's really well conceived around all the stuff, all the things around value-based healthcare. Mm-hmm. And 100%. I think it's a stream of research I'm engaged with. I think I work very closely, as many do people do, with Associate Professor Emily Callender, a health economist now at Monash. And I think that we have got an opportunity to really start to say to ourselves, what, and they call them patient-reported outcome measures and patient-reported experience measures, need to be built in. And then how do we measure outcomes? It might be patient-reported, but might be reported through other mechanisms. How do we measure the sorts of outcomes that we think make big ticket items to lifelong health. And I think that the study that Jane Sandel was involved with, there's a poppy study around preterm birth, started to explore that, as others have. But yeah, what is it doing around breastfeeding self-efficacy, longer term breast exclusive breastfeeding particularly? What's it doing around confidence as a mother, mother infant bonding, fatigue, incontinence, pain? You know, what does it measure around all those? What does it measure in terms of sense of community, in terms of, I don't know, family connectedness, in terms of domestic and family violence? Perinatal mental health is measured, but it's still measured in a very much it's still very much tackled in an individualistic type of way. Like that, we don't start to say to ourselves, why is it that it's such a struggle for so many women when they become mothers? What's going on as a sort of community, societal process that leaves them so bereft of the sorts of care and support that they need? So, and we'll talk about that when I get onto my PhD, which is about post-traumatic stress disorder, of course. You know, what's iatrogenic? And Professor Leslie Barclay, of course, well, many of your listeners will also know, co-authored a fabulous paper a long time ago called The Misery of Motherhood. And she started to frame up that notion of the misery of motherhood, which we would call depression, but from a very you know, societal, sociological point of view, rather than as individual failing or weakness or vulnerability or inadequacy. You know, the people talk about resilience, God, and they talk about, you know, coping and enhancing coping. And, you know, it's pretty damn clear that the best way to, the most universal way to reduce distress in women when they become mothers over the pregnancy or postpartum is social support. Yeah. Social support's the big mitigator of perinatal mental health problems. Anyway, we digress. Into the evidence already.
We go, but this is what it is. It kind of does it. And that listening to you then is looking at, and I'm thinking automatically of the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale, which is kind of useless in a way. And a lot of people have said they kind of lied on it, because they gave the results that they thought that the healthcare workers wanted. But when you look at the ANQR, and there's a couple of others, they've added some extra questions there, and they're now looking at what your childhood experiences are and what your relationships are, and actually going back to the ACE, the Adverse Childhood Experiences measures as well, because it is all that relationship. It is that intergenerational trauma. It is that bonding and attachment. It's more than just this one experience here. So we are slowly changing and broadening out that concept, but then we're not necessarily have enough in place to deal with it. And then to actually go, well, we've got this result, but then what do we do with it now?
And we'll talk about that as we go through, because I think there are lots of what do we do about it that are as yet unexplored, and, in fact, midwives could have a massive role in.
Absolutely. So let's get on to your then postgraduate career. So what got you into study and postgrad? Why did you do research? Because it's something that it's so easy for us to get caught in clinical careers and to go, we need to make a difference here. Brainiacs or people that are far smarter than me do PhDs. That's not my track. So we're trying to hopefully improve that everyone can do a PhD if they've got the right support. So what got you onto that kind of like pathway that has in fact changed your life?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I've always been political. You know, in those days, independent midwife, other independent midwives would say, and midwives say this quite a lot, Jenny, I just want to care for women. And initially I was probably a little bit more tolerant, but over the years I got less tolerant, and I do through gritted teeth now, and they're not going to let you. So that's what midwives really want to do. They just want to care. They just want to provide great care to women. And then other independent midwives would say, and anybody who's anywhere close to my age is going to they're going to have heard this before, I'm just trying to fly under the radar.
Yep.
And I'd say, they're going to hunt you down. They're not going to let you fly under the radar. So and in fact, that I think both of those things are true. Yep. I still think both of those responses to those sort of comments are true. But I get it that midwives are often geared from their own backgrounds and their own orientation to just really want to be with women. That's why they chose midwifery. So, you know, it's a great thing. Thank goodness midwives want to be with women. It's been the joy of my life, and it's the thing that's driven me on, that desire to improve the care that women and babies receive. So why did I get into it? Well, I'm fundamentally political. And one of the things that was giving me the absolute shits in the, when did I do my master's, 90s, was the chat in obstetrics generally, but private obstetrics particularly, that the rising cesarean section rate was as a result of women's request for cesarean. And this was the age of choice and control. So they requested it. They would act as if their hands were tied behind their back. What am I to do? You know, the woman's asking for a cesarean section. She has a right to bodily autonomy, choice and control. So I provide a cesarean section. That pissed me right off.
Yep.
So I basically did my master's research looking at women's preferred type of birth, and I surveyed them at 36 weeks in the old days where, you know, surveys were on clipboards in antenatal clinics and people were recruited. And I had a standard blurb chat to them. The antenatal clinics had sufficiently long waits, and women just completed a survey. The survey had 8 options for giving birth and asked a range of questions, including, do you know one benefit of a cesarean section for you and the baby? Do you know one risk of cesarean section for you and the baby? They were probably the few open-ended questions, although most of the fixed response questions had another option with an opportunity to write that in. The survey tool worked really, really well, and I published 2 papers from it. One was the main results paper, and one was a conceptual and methodological review of the literature. But the other thing that I think was unique about that study, I think it still is unique, was the only one globally that recruited a representative sample of women using private obstetrics and the public sector. So despite the fact that I've been an independent midwife, despite the fact that everybody knew I was political, 6 private obstetricians agreed, shockingly, surprisingly, agreed to allow me to recruit women from their rooms.
That says quite a lot, actually, back in those days.
Well, what it really says is that they were absolutely convinced, I think, in their own mind. Yeah. That I would show, that the survey would show, and because it was a survey, that most of them asked to see the survey before they agreed.
Yep.
They did. Of course they did. It was no drama. This was a survey. It wasn't going to be a secret women's business. And they agreed to let me sit in their rooms. That was just, even that was telling how quickly they could get a heavily pregnant woman down the corridor, on the little bed, off the little bed and out again. Yep. Really shocked me, I have to say. And the long waits that many women did sitting in the rooms of private obstetricians. So the long and the short of that is we had a representative sample. I had a representative sample of women using the public sector and private sector. And surprise, surprise. So in a way, I already had my discussion chapter written before I started the study. If lots of women requested a cesarean section, this was about the transmission of the medical views and medical paradigms into community norms.
Yep.
If, in fact, few women wanted a cesarean section, well, then they're lying. So easy. So, in fact, when it came to write my discussion, my supervisor's like, Jenny, are we right with this? I'm right. and I was off. So, in fact, 0.3% of women requested a cesarean section in the absence of a current or previous obstetric complication.
Wow, that's our equivalent to our home birth rate at the moment.
Yeah, and 6% if you take into account current and previous obstetric complications, and they won't come as a surprise to you: twins, breech, previous section. Yep. And when you asked women if you wanted a cesarean section, why did you want it? A big list of fixed responses with another box: because the doctor recommended it. Well, come on, you know, come on. That what they're really doing is consenting to the advice of their and the recommendation of their doctor. So anyway, beautiful paper, wrote it up. We updated the literature review and split it into 2 papers a few years later to separate out the conceptual and methodological stuff. Showed the literature review then showed the same sort of issues. Few women request a cesarean section in the absence of obstetric or obstetric complications. So nothing's changed in that, I don't think, and I'm pretty keen to start exploring that area again because, of course, I got sidetracked in all the other massively interesting areas of research and have a way too diverse research portfolio.
Well, I may, in fact, have a future colleague for you to work with because one of my honours students actually looking at, we've got a survey going out at the moment and she'll be writing it up next year. She's actually looking at what influences a woman's choice for her mode of birth, though I sadly don't expect you to see much difference, even though it has been 30 years.
Oh, section rates keep going up. They keep going up. So, no, I think just before I came to the UK, I co-led a consultancy for Queensland Health to co-design a multi-pronged evidence-based normal birth strategy. So the drivers of cesarean section aren't a surprise to anybody. Induction of labour, use of epidurals, they drive the cesarean section rate. Same old reasons for why women are given a cesarean section, whatever you like to call it, failure to progress and suspected fetal distress. But what drives it, I think, is quite interesting. And for your honours student, I think that you'll find the answer is everything. Everything influences women. The bigger question for me is how do you enable women to reclaim birth on their really on their terms with an understanding of the potential of birth as a existential peak experience.
Mm. And it's hard when you've got society messages saying a C-section, you go home after 2 days. Like it's not that big a deal. You can go home after 2 days. The hospitals are pushing them out. We know the research is showing that there is a difference between gut biome within the differences in the births. There's so much else coming out. But when you've got society saying, oh, it's not that big a deal, you can go out, it's major abdominal surgery. Like the consequences of it are downplayed by society too much. That also is hard to kind of play against, like the normal vaginal birth and the recovery. So, how do we flip that? How do we change that?
Even back in the day, for the group of women who wanted, said they preferred a cesarean section, because the doctor recommended it, when I asked that question about a benefit of cesarean and a risk of cesarean for themselves and their baby, the risk was so underplayed, like it was so minimized. It was shocking that they had such little understanding of the negative impact, the potential negative impact, well, the actual negative impact, because there's some you can't avoid if you have a cesarean section, and the potential other negative outcomes from a cesarean section. They just don't know that. So I think they are also things that we need to tackle. Yeah, for sure.
Cool. So that's another topic you've put a pin in and you're about to take that pin out and explore some more. So
yeah, hope
now,
so.
Now you're going on to your PhD.
Yeah, well, so I did my master's research. That was a very positive journey for me overall. I published 2 papers from it. Over that process, I was doing other bits of work, including working on a project for Professor Deborah Creedy in the Forensic Mental Health Unit in Queensland at Wollstone Park with the staff around ethics of care and all that sort of stuff. Super interesting. But that got me introduced to Deborah. Deborah's an amazing woman and an amazing researcher, amazing mentor and leader. And so she unofficially supervised me and I published with her through my master's and only because I couldn't get it formally recognised. And then she was my natural choice of a PhD supervisor. I wasn't rushing towards my PhD, I have to say, but she was very convincing. So I got a scholarship. She got a small grant. I got all that money too. And I did a bit of sessional teaching and did my PhD. And really, it flowed nicely on from my master's research about women's preferred type of birth, because it looked at women who had traumatic childbirth. And, you know, we know that some of those women who had a very negative experience or a traumatic experience in a previous pregnancy will choose, or are vicariously traumatized by the stories of others, yeah, might put in a request for a cesarean section as one of their options. And certainly as a home birth midwife for 10 years, I definitely had that group of women seeking a home birth. There were women who knew, they'd say things like, I can't do that again. So they found themselves pregnant, not necessarily by choice or design, but they didn't want to terminate, and they knew they couldn't do that again. By that meaning that type of experience, institutionalized, hospitalized, medicalized experience again. So some of those women would choose private midwifery practice with home birth or hospital birth. So I sort of felt like I knew a sample of those women. And so looking at post-traumatic stress disorder was a pretty natural thing to do. Deborah, for her PhD, had looked at a prevalence and contributing factors to the development of post-traumatic stress disorder. So she's knowledgeable in the area, but not a midwife. She's a nurse, my background, and a clinical psychologist. So we're a happy little team, and had another couple of other supervisors who are also excellent. And, we traversed the journey. But I guess I was always a bit grumpy in the beginning about wanting to do something upstream rather than downstream. But nevertheless, it taught me all the skills of doing a PhD, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. If you do ever get a chance to do a PhD on a scholarship and do it full time, I would highly recommend it. And I'd also highly recommend you do it that way and then try to piece together the rest of your finances. It's never going to be a thing that everybody can do, but I wouldn't be super shy about it. You know what I mean? Leap in the net will appear, and then you can sort of create the other little bits of income that come your way. And as an experienced PhD supervisor now, there's rules around scholarships, like 9 hours work a week or whatever. And if you look closely at the rules, they say 9 hours of work a week in business hours. Well, yep, that's perfect for midwives because you can do a 12-hour shift on a weekend. Yep. So I just think more flexibly about your PhD income, whilst you're journeying through your PhD. And with the students I supervise, I just say you just need to make full-time progress. I don't care how many hours a week you work.
And that's where the countries are very different in their system. The UK system is very different to Australian system. And there's so many, like I've had the privilege of talking with a lot of international midwives, that they physically have to move lock, stock and barrel countries to actually do it for 3 years. And, of course, with COVID, one of my master's students about to go home, and she hasn't been home for 2 years and hasn't seen her kind of four-year-old daughter. And so you sit there, the sacrifices that they make to actually do this because they want to better the midwifery in their country is just amazing. And doing it in another language.
The universities in many countries in the world can be extraordinarily rigid and myopic about how they grow, how they create enabling environments for PhD students.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And I disapprove.
And there's a lot of decentralization. There's a lot of not allowing individual disciplines to continue. It's all this homogenized, you're doing a health science honors or you're doing a master's of health or something instead of a master's in midwifery or a master's in nursing. It's all consolidating it so that it's easier to run, so it takes less admin. But it also scares people away because they don't necessarily then think they're going to have the support to specialise in the discipline that they want to.
In another podcast, we should talk about that notion of managerialism centralisation, homogenisation, because I think it's happening across industries, and in the process of it, manages institutionalised risk, but it in fact has a range of negative consequences for the recipients of the services. And so I'm thinking banking. So if you're a customer of the bank, or you're an employee of the bank, or you're a customer of the university, like a student, or an employee of the university, it has negative consequences for all of us, but it's a way of managing the institutional risk by standardizing,
yep.
homogenizing, role. It's cost effective, but it's also ass covering approach to life. That's a different podcast, I reckon.
That is a different podcast. Yes.
Happy to join you for that.
That would be a very interesting one. It would be interesting to get a panel together for that one, I think, because that could be quite entertaining. Because it is the encouragement.
Good to do it as a panel, not just of midwife academics or midwives, but banking, insurance. Like a range of, there's a range, seems to me there's a range of different services that go down this route. Anyway, that is definitely another podcast.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the issues is the encouragement and the pushing towards group supervision instead of individual supervision. And I think that's where you can leave some students behind. But that's also when we also see the students need to do it and we'll actually do it within our own time because we want to support them. So we'll keep encouraging them to do that. And because we have that belief in what they're doing, but also in improving the profession as well.
So at Griffith, we, Kirsten, in fact, led this, Dr. Kirsten Small, led a PhD peer group. So there's a difference between peer groups,
yep.
peer support groups that the supervisors may or may not, you know, it'd be great if some attend some other time, but they're fundamentally a peer group versus group supervision. I think I haven't got much time for group supervision. I think it slows the whole thing down for the students, really. Mm-hmm. Having a peer group is a great idea, but
yep.
But having targeted, focused attention to you and your PhD journey, I think just helps them make better progress.
And that's where those conversations, if you've had those targeted conversations, that allows your brain to kind of keep percolating. But also when you go back and listen, and I record all of my sessions and I, with my students, I record them and send them the audio as well. It's like you go back and listen to it and you kind of go, oh, I don't have to take notes because I can actually be involved in that conversation instead of madly trying to listen to what they're saying. And then you go back and listen to it and you kind of go, oh, wow, that's actually a really good thing. Now I've got to go off and follow in that pathway because it lightens up more paths to explore through.
Yeah, as a supervisor, I ask the student to write me a dot point, just an email, write us a dot point summary of the next steps, really, within 48 hours of the meeting. My God, that's really telling, especially in the early days when you've had this sort of, you know, 45-minute-hour supervisory meeting and then you get these dot points back 2 days later, you think there's nothing about that. It melds with my recall of the situation. So it really helps keep the two of you on track.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Well, the supervisory team and the student on track in terms of what's next, what's the thinking, what needs sorting, what's next. Yeah.
I think it's Hugh Kearns. He's got some great templates to help with that as well, to kind of like keep you on track and to go, you write the agenda. It's your meeting. You write the agenda of what you want to kind of discuss and go through and help contain your supervisors as well, because they can kind of go off and you got to bring them back again.
Yeah. However, I like the idea of a co-created agenda. Mm-hmm. Like, because the supervisors bring things too.
Oh, so absolutely.
This is what I want on the agenda, and they say, well, this is what I want on the agenda, and I can go.
But that's it, taking that first 5 minutes just to check in and go, what do you want to talk? Or having it sent beforehand so everyone
beforehand's
knows.
Beforehand's good, but, you know, beforehand's good, but at the meeting's okay too.
So talk about your process with your PhD then. So you did it full-time, you had the support. Were there times, because we know about, now was it kind of two-thirds of PhDs don't complete because an assortment of reasons, and it could even be higher in some areas. We know that there's a high level of mental health issues within PhD students because of a lot of the isolation and the idea that it has to be a 7-day-a-week project for 12 hours a day to kind of get it finished. And in some disciplines, at some periods, it could be like that. But how did you structure your PhD to actually have a life, survive a life? Did you, what sacrifices did you make to kind of go through that? Because you obviously had data collection time, then analysis time. Like, how did you structure yours?
Good question. Okay, so I had run a private midwifery practice with all of that entails for 10 years. So I recruited new people when the first people moved on, like Jen Fenwick and Geraldine Fitzpatrick, moved on. So I mentored new people into the practice. I did all of the business of the practice, all the invoicing of the practice, all the meetings of the hospital, just about, not all of it, but like 90% of all the meetings, about 90%, but everything else, 100%. Negotiation with the health department, writing stuff up, collecting the stats, bringing them together for our monthly meetings, organising our monthly meetings, blah, 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 blah. So I'd run the practice for 10 years. In the context of that 10 years, the obstetricians had pulled out and we were overnight, our business was decimated. We had a whole lot of women on our books that didn't have any, they had planned hospital births, their model of care and their caregivers were up shit creek without a paddle. And some of those were in late pregnancy. So I had to do emergency arrangements to cover the existing case. So honestly, doing a PhD was a dream. It was a dream. So it was, and in that 10 years, I had two babies. My first daughter was stillborn. So it was like far out, such a hard decade. Being an independent midwife is hard.
Yep.
Because of the politics of the situation, the care aspects of it are beautiful, but you know, like everything else aspects of it, the running the business and the politics aspects of it are hard. And then, I had two babies. My first baby, Katie, was stillborn at term. My second baby, Nicole, lucky me to be pregnant with lovely Nicole. But, you know, she was a transvestite at 40 weeks. I did have lost a litre and a half of blood. She was turned. I had a normal birth. I lost a litre and a half of blood. She was misdiagnosed with Down syndrome. So, but basically, and I was 16 days late when I went into labour. So, but basically, by the time she was a week old, let's say, she'd got rid of her Down syndrome. I was still tired from my postpartum hemorrhage, but we were all fine. And since then, she's been dream daughter. But nevertheless, I had two pregnancies and two babies in that decade. So honestly, doing a PhD on a scholarship, I'm like, oh, God.
Yes.
So you do work hard, but I've also got a few other really key philosophies in life. When you're tired, rest. When you're sick, rest. When you're fed up with the world, rest. So I'm not a soldier on person. I'm pretty self-determining, probably why I'm an independent midwife. I'm not too hung up on the expectations of others, and I'm clear about – I'm a driven person, but I'm clear about what's for me and what's not for me. Mm-hmm. So by the time I was doing a PhD, Nicole was born in 94. So she was about six when I started, and I basically geared my PhD around her because, quite frankly, I'd just been in private practice for the last 10 years. You don't gear anything around anybody much, except the women, of course. And then so what I did is I would drop her at school. I'd ride my bike to uni. I had a little office there, do a day's worth, 6 hours worth really of PhD, go and get her from school. So I had some arrangements a couple of days a week, art classes Mondays. Siobhan picked her up Tuesday and Wednesday, so I had some cover, but basically by 4:30 or 5 I'd pick her up. Sometimes I'd pick her up straight from school, and so a great time for her and me as well. And then when she went to bed at night, I'd do another couple of hours. So basically I did a day's work every day, and then there were sometimes times on the weekend she had friends over or she'd have gone to a friend's place. I'd do a few more hours, and then I'd do a few more hours in the evening, and I'm still work very much like that. I learned this as an independent midwife, that I live a fully integrated life. I hate the idea of work-life balance. I think it's stupid. We're women, we're carers, we're workers, we're everything. So I just think you live a fully integrated life. And for that, that means I'll do my bloody emails when I like. I'll do everything when I like. So I choose my own path. So if that means working on the weekend, if it means getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and if it means working to midnight or 2 o'clock to get a grant done, I don't care. But I'm also not going to march to the beat of your drum the next day when I'm tired. And in fact, I've been known at Griffith to have a little nana nap lying down on the floor in my office at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, because if you're tired, you rest. Yes. So I just have a very free and self-determining approach to these things.
Well, it's clearly worked for you. and continues to work for you. And it can't go wrong because Italy and Spain still have siestas, and they've kind of like it's that time rest and then kind of work a bit later in the evening.
Like it might be 5 minutes, it might be 20 minutes, it might be not at all. The purpose is be self-determining.
Mm. So with your PhD, what's the things that still stick in your mind from the findings of that?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so about 30% of women reported that their birth was traumatic. That's been pretty standard and stable before and after my PhD. That doesn't mean they all go on to develop post-traumatic stress symptoms or disorder, but it's still very telling about our maternity services that they report that their birth was traumatic. And for women in my PhD, they met the criterion, the DSM-4, I think it was at that stage, Diagnostic and Statistics Manual number 4, I think it's number 5 or 6 now, for they met criterion A for a traumatic event. So that sticks in my mind. One of the things I did as part of my PhD was look at all the literature about the existing psychological therapies. And that was very, very instructive for me, but was, and I wrote, looked at tons and wrote tons about it, and then fundamentally chucked just about all of it out. And so part of my PhD, the first component of my PhD was developing a midwife-led counselling intervention for women who reported a traumatic birth. And, you know, clearly it's got elements of all sorts of things in there. It's got elements of CBT. It's got elements of psychotherapy. It's got elements of, like, a Rogerian approach. But more than that, I think it is fundamentally born out of deeply woman-centered care from with a midwife perspective, because you've got to remember, for the 10 years before, a good number of the women that I'd cared for chose to have a home birth in their subsequent pregnancy because their previous pregnancy was a traumatic experience. They are quite typically, I think, it's not unusual for that to be a cohort of women choosing home birth, especially choosing private home birth. The Maltese who don't come to have a home birth the first time, it's because that's not their it's not their enculturated leaning to do that. So they have a hospital birth, feel screwed over, and then choose a home birth. So I sort of felt I knew those women, and I used the skills that I'd used with those women, really. So that was a very interesting process for me, and I had to have obviously a validated process. So I did focus groups with midwives, focus groups with women, and did a process, a research process, basically to test out my ideas, and then structured the counselling approach, and then applied that in a randomised controlled trial with women only in the public sector. So I recruited women antenatally, and then I saw them within a 36 hours postnatally on the postnatal ward, asked them the questions about whether their birth was traumatic, and then talked to them then, but then talked to them again at 4 to 6 weeks postpartum. So super interesting. And then measured outcomes again at 3 months postpartum by phone.
Yep.
That bit, the counselling and the final outcome measurement by phone. So that was really fascinating. But then the thing that struck me in delivering the counselling intervention and talking with women who'd reported a traumatic childbirth was the high levels of self-blame. And it was an element of the counselling intervention to specifically address self-blame. And the self-blame was absolutely everything. I went to hospital too early, chose the wrong doctor, chose the wrong hospital, shouldn't have had an epidural, shouldn't have agreed to this, should have taken greater control in participating, should have prepared my husband more, should have. And it was quite difficult to counteract. So for me, the most effective way was to take a bit of time to explain the difference between reasonable expectations and realistic expectations. So I said what you did was reasonable, and you had reasonable expectations. You had reasonable expectations that your care providers would be sensitive to your needs, aware of your needs, that listen to you when you're communicating, ask you specifically about your needs, participate and partner with you in decision making, and show you respect and compassion, and provide you with technically competent care. All of that is reasonable.
Absolutely. But it doesn't happen.
Exactly. It's just unrealistic.
And our language doesn't help either. When we've got things like failure to progress, we've got such blame language that, and semantics is a big issue, that it is very much a blame language that kind of compounds that thinking within the woman herself.
And I think that women generally are enculturated to blame themselves and take responsibility.
Yeah.
So that helped. And then the other bit that was always struck me was the notion of I'm never going, and they don't mean like once you're a mother, you're never going to be the same again, which is the same for all of us, but it's that notion of never going to be the same again. And what they meant was that shakeup of worldview. What they meant is that I'm never going to be the same person again. So that was quite confronting too. And look, I was really glad I did the counselling intervention by phone, I have to say, because sometimes I'll be like, but still gave us opportunity to explore what that really meant, which I think was useful. Women would say things like, I can't, my husband's sick of listening to me, which is sad in itself. Some women would say, I can't even tell my mother how distressed I am because I know how distressed she will be about my level of distress. So they were quite isolated. So exploring I'll never be the same again was interesting. I guess what you want to do is not argue with that or dismiss that. In fact, I think that's entirely right. So I used to say to her, you'll never be the same again.
Yep.
But that doesn't mean you're destroyed or that you're rubbish or that you have no value. It just means you've changed. And what does that change look like? So I used this a few times because after the first time I used it, it was an analogy. After the first time I used it, the woman had my phone number. She rang me up a couple of weeks later and she said, out of everything we've talked about, this was the most useful thing to say. So I tested it out on a few other women in the next time. I said, is that helpful to talk about like that? And they'd say, yes, that's super helpful. And again, I said, let it ruminate for a while. And if you wouldn't mind, give me some feedback in a few weeks' time because I don't want to just sort of like, be sentimental about it and gloss over it. And they would. So that was quite a nice little iterative process I built into my PhD, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
So I'd say to them, they were like a eucalypt that had been, beautiful tall eucalypt that had been struck by lightning in a storm, burnt out, all its leaves, all its smaller branches burnt off, and people think it's dead. The next rain comes and all this new growth comes.
Yeah.
And it's not the same tree, but it's still a beautiful tree. In fact, so much so that people will often admire it, especially painters will paint it and people will photograph it, and it's a specially admired tree. But it's also a home for, it's got broken off limbs and things, a home for possums and birds and, it's a home for others. And I said, you've got a level of insight now that you got through pain and hardship and distress, but in a way you can't get any other way. And so you are too a home for others. And they were like, yes. So they seemed to resonate strongly that change doesn't mean, it means different. It doesn't mean worse. But there is also grief in letting go of the carefree previous you to this new, I've been through something huge and traumatic you.
And that's an imagery, especially in Australia, that's very easy to identify, and it is something like we've had major bushfires in the last couple of years, and especially here in South Australia with Kangaroo Island, a beautiful place that kind of got decimated. But the news was not only of the horror and the army going there to help the wild animals, but it was the first budding of those trees. And it was like it was a lead of the news, like all this stuff is happening, but the lead of the news is these trees are coming back. There's life still there. So I think that analogy is something that a lot of Australians and obviously other people as well, but is easy to grasp onto as that turning something negative into positive. So that's something.
It seemed to, and I didn't ever want to dismiss the loss of the previous self or the pain that went into it. I just wanted to give a sense that you're not now you shouldn't now consider yourself on the rubbish heap of life,
yeah.
that you are valued, valuable, have beauty, have purpose, just different. So lots of learnings out of doing a PhD, and lots of learnings about topic, but lots of learning about process, lots of learning about yourself. I had marvelous supervision. Deborah Creedy is my long-term friend, my long-term collaborator, and I just admire her greatly. And the opportunity to work with her through my PhD was great. I sometimes think now, many years later, I can't remember how to do anything as a researcher because you're so busy running research teams that you lots of the jobs you never do yourself. And I think, oh, well, life moves on.
You're sharing your knowledge with the future generations.
Yeah, sometimes I think they teach me equally or as much or more than I teach them. But anyway, it's all good.
But that's where it should be. When you stop learning is when you die. Like we should be learning and aiming to learn every day off of everything that we do.
Yeah. So it definitely is a momentous time of your life, I think.
You were talking about upstream and downstream, and then that was very much downstream. How do we change it so that we don't have that degree of women having traumatic births? And I know that I tell my students, it's got nothing to do with you about what you see. You can see a beautiful birth and it can still be traumatic for the woman who's experiencing it for whatever reason it happens. So how do we as midwives, how do we change that? Because it seems to be increasing.
Yeah. Look, I'm not sure I'm a big agreeer with what you just said. Can it be a beautiful birth in the eyes of the midwife or student midwife and a traumatic birth for the woman? Yes, but that's rare. The most common situation is poor technical care or unkind, disrespectful, lack of compassionate care, and that goes hand in hand with decision making. So I think, with my colleagues, a lot of it led by Jen Fennick, have done work around fear of birth as well. Joss Tuhill did her PhD in a randomized control trial looking at fear of birth and ways to ameliorate fear in childbearing women during pregnancy that was successful. We modified the intervention that I used for women who had a traumatic childbirth and applied it to women who were fearful of birth. So all doable, but fundamentally then we looked to see if we could implement this fear of birth counselling intervention in a health service. And so we did an implementation study, and what we found is that in fragmented care, you couldn't, because they didn't have enough continuity of the woman, they didn't have strength of relationship with the woman, they just didn't simply have enough flexibility in the application of time that they gave to the woman and when that time was allocated. So I think it's very unusual for a woman to feel traumatized out of a birth that a midwife would say was a lovely, normal birth, because they're just not the factors that are most strongly associated with traumatic birth. And I think the only way that we're going to get around this is deinstitutionalized, relationship-based continuity and midwifery care.
Mm-hmm.
But I use those two words ahead of continuity and midwifery care advisedly, because I think that you can still set up continuity of midwifery care in ways that is heavily institutionalized, and therefore in the process erodes the ability of the midwife to really have a connected relationship with the woman. So, but that's the answer. That's the answer, relationship-based, deinstitutionalized continuity of midwifery care. I mean, the change is happening, but too slow, and it's easily eroded, very, very easily eroded. So we need to reorientate the way we educate midwives so that they do more and more provision of continuity of midwifery care as students, both in continuity models and in fragmented models, and yet we've reduced the numbers. At each iteration of the standards in Australia, I would suggest that we have to move quite quickly to full continuity. Like that is the only practice model, with the exception being, I don't know, maybe some shifts on the postnatal ward, you know, at some point over their program, education program. So I mean, I think all of those things are difficult to advance, because the power of midwifery in the system and the visibility and recognition of the value of midwife-led care, midwife as primary caregiver, and midwife in continuity of care models, and the universal accessibility of that. should be universal. It should be the foundational model. Every woman should have continuity of midwifery care, and some women also need obstetric and other types of care.
Absolutely.
Anyway, we've got a long way to go, but I'm not the only one singing from that song sheet.
No, but it has dragged you post your PhD when you look at the organisations and associations or consortiums that you have helped grow in that respect. And two in particular is one's the, I call it the TMAC because it's just lazy, Trans-Tasman Midwifery Education Consortium, which I'm kind of thankfully a rep for Flinders University on and kind of love sitting there listening to everyone talk. But also there's the Transforming Midwifery Care.
Transforming Maternity Care Collaborative. Yeah.
Once again, it's all the initials.
Yeah, that's right, all the bloody initials, that's right. So the Trans-Tasman Midwifery Education Consortium was simply born out of that notion of how do we use education standards to advance midwifery education, advance it. You know, every iteration, every review should take us forward in an educational sense, but also in terms of strengthening the midwifery profession. It's such a cornerstone, it's such a keystone of having a strong profession, is to enable you to facilitate the learning, grow the graduates, you know, really have a very, very clear idea on what graduate outcomes look like from a program leading to registration as a midwife. So that came out of that. I think I talked to Mary, we're having a little bitch session, and I said, well, there's others that feel like we do. So we contacted the few that we felt were most closely aligned, Deb Davis, Linda Sweet, and we really just got together and we went, let's start something. Lois McKellar, God, she's awesome. And then people were so hungry for it, so hungry for it, that they flocked in, and we've done awesome amounts of work together. And it's got a life of its own. Like, it's got momentum and it's got commitment. And we've done two conferences now. I think the virtual one was harder for everybody, but the first one we did, I think, was in 2018 on the Gold Coast. We ran it through Griffith. Thank you, Griffith. People were saying it's the first time they've done sessions, like the concurrent sessions, where they've had so many people in the room, because they're all educators, so they're all fantastically interested in the topics that were being presented. It was really, really successful, and that galvanised the group further. And the group's got, you know, we did a Delphi study to talk about what the priorities of midwifery education are, and they're the themes of those. We organise the work of the consortium around, and you know all this, Liz. Yep. It's got a energy. And it's got a momentum, but I think what always strikes me so starkly, so clearly, so strongly, is the genuine desire to collaborate, to share, to include, to advance. Like, we're super vision values aligned group. Even people who work in universities that feel that their university isn't as well signed up to this as they are individually. Yes. So it's terrific.
And I think it also shows the fundamentals when we look at the State of Midwifery report, and we know that the pillars are, it's the clinical, it's the education, and it's the governance. And when without those three pillars, they all need research to be able to show that what we're doing is evidence-based. So we need the research to show for the education, we need that research and the clinicians to be able to teach to the future kind of graduates. But we also need it to how we get covenants and how we change and how we talk into what we need. And that's that interprofessional relationship. And that's how we do transform maternity care, because it's more than just the midwives at the end of the bed. There's a whole team of people that need to be brought in, but also different points of views need to be taken into consideration. And one day we will have chief midwives in every country. We will have them at the table where all the decisions are made within healthcare, but also within budgeting, within roads, when we look at the social determinants. And we'll kind of like, this is where it all starts, with this kind of gathering of evidence and sharing of evidence. Well, that's what I kind of want to keep pushing out there.
Yeah, and there's definitely a political element to Trans-Tasman Midwifery Education Consortium, and learning from, sharing and learning from each other across the Tasman is also quite, I think, a very, very valuable aspect to the consortium. So we'd started that first, but I'd already started conceptualizing that notion of what are the drivers of practice. So exactly right, Liz, is that It's those elements of education and education-related research, all things about the workforce, particularly the midwifery workforce, all things about, taking a not only survive but a health promotion, public health, health advancement, health enhancing aspect to it, which we've called public health, and practice translation. How do you get the evidence into practice? So we form the Transforming Maternity Care Collaborative. And again, I think for me, very strongly, you have to work out what your vision is and what your values are, because it just guides, it just makes every other bit of decision making easier. And it brings the right like minds together, I think, too. They can work out easily whether this is the thing for them.
Yep.
And that's going quite well. We started in late 2019, then COVID. Then everybody changing jobs, but and we probably work at this stage more as a consultancy than as a research group. We're not a community of practice. We're not a research support organisation to others. We're reliant on external funding. We had some good setup money that I collected along. Mary and I had collected along the way, but that's always time limited. It's once used up, it's used up. So. As I said, we did a small consultancies before we came away. We've done a couple of other small consultancies that start to grow business in that area, and we're looking to do further consultancies. But again, we'll only be looking to do consultancies that are aligned with our vision and values and that advance that bigger picture of promoting universal access to continuity of care for women, but also making sure that those continuity care models really deliver the goods. They really deliver on what we know can be delivered. I gave you my stats, 7% section rate, 11% transfer rate. Yeah, but we've got all those fantastic systematic reviews that show us what the benchmark is, really. Yeah. And I appreciate that that getting certain sort of outcomes in a randomized control trial versus real life, the messiness of real life. You know, in a randomized control trial, I can exclude a whole lot of people and include them and tightly control your intervention. I appreciate that real life is messier than that. However, we definitely have a clear idea about the sorts of outcomes that can be improved if we get it right.
And I think that's where the global, and I think COVID-19 has helped with this, that the global barriers have come down. And I know that there's been a lot more outreach from people connecting with other people who are interested. And I know Twitter's kind of quite handy with that, and so has LinkedIn in its own ways. But would you recommend people who are interested in those kind of areas to start exploring and finding out who the researchers are in those areas and touching base with them and saying, look, I'm interested in this, how do I get involved? Kind of putting themselves out there to try and start their own networks?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's absolutely important. You can't, as I said, well, I often say I can't do anything alone, which is sort of true. I just don't have the skill base. But I also, I've forgotten everything I learned in my PhD. Sometimes it feels like that. How do you search a database again?
Well, they keep changing the bloody mechanisms. That's the problem.
I know. It's not, which is not true, but, it is a life of learning, isn't it? Every day's a day at school. But also because as a manager, as a leader, but also as a researcher, you need to test your ideas on others. So, you can talk to yourself. It all makes perfect sense to yourself.
Yep.
But once you try to explain or teach it to others, as as a teacher yourself, or in developing an idea, you want to post the idea in a way that enables people to say, oh, that's complete rubbish. But more often than not, they'll take a kernel of that idea and build on it. So, and they just add so much. So you've got to sort of test it. Does this hold water? How does this resonate with people? Am I explaining it clearly? But in the process, the idea is enriched.
Yeah.
So all research should be collaborative research. The midwifery voice needs to be strong in that research. That's the bit that's missing, I think, globally, is our voice in all levels, leadership and everywhere else. So midwives need to be not shy about holding back, and even if what they think they're about to say might sound stupid, because sometimes it's not entirely stupid. There might be stupid elements of it, but it's not entirely stupid. And if they've got qualms, those qualms should be on the table, not in their mind. So bring their best self to work without getting too hung up about whether the best is good enough, and participate and collaborate. I read a paper many years ago called, collaboration, a misnomer for something or other. And it was, I did it with Dennis Walsh. Many people might not know Dennis Walsh, but I certainly do, and he's amazing. And it was really to unpick the notion of clinical practice and collaboration, to start to say, are we collaborating or are we just acquiescing? You know, so collaboration means you've got to bring full self into the party. You know, you've got to contribute. It's not necessarily the other people's problem. You have to bring your full contribution and make sure that that's heard and understood by the people you're trying to collaborate with. So I'd say the same goes for research. You have to, So it's multidisciplinary collaboration and teamwork. Misnomers for subjugation was the title of the paper. I know. Went off like a cracker, that one. So you see this thing called interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary and collaboration and all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, it's not really collaboration in my view. It's really, compromise, acceptance.
Attendance. You're just attending.
Agreements. They don't agree. They don't necessarily agree. So I would encourage midwives to be bold and brave, because we have expertise that women need, and we should offer it in environments where offer it and insist that others at least hear our view in all forums, including in research forums. Mm. So, yeah, I've probably got unusual views about that, but I just can't see what I'd call genuine collaboration happening very often, because the power differential is so significant.
And we can see that within government, within funding, within disciplines. You can see that at a meeting and across discipline, who kind of, and also gender. And we're looking at gender as well. All of those kind of come in. And I mean, I keep telling my students that midwifery is political. It's personally political. It's women's centre political. It's locally, it's nationally, and it's internationally. And if they don't like politics, they're in the wrong job, because they're going to have to deal with it on multiple levels. So question to come back. How did you celebrate the end of your PhD?
Oh, look, I was pleased to get my PhD. I'm not a big, I'm not a very sentimental person. I'm not a very big person for ceremonies, although it was one of the ceremonies I did go to. I did actually walk across the stage to get my PhD. I had a scenic rich tertiary education. You know, I didn't finish high school. I did two certificates, nursing and midwifery, did a diploma in nursing education because you couldn't do anything in midwifery education, a bachelor's degree in nursing, a master's by research, and then my PhD. So I think I went to one of those graduations prior to my PhD. And I did go to my PhD when my husband and my daughter were in the audience, and she'd forgotten her glasses, so she couldn't see me anyway. And but for me, I didn't particularly need to celebrate my PhD, and I didn't. I got my first job as an academic and got on with teaching everything and running the shit Masters of Midwifery program that I inherited, got rid of that. I didn't need to. The joy, the celebration had been the 3 years of doing my PhD.
Yeah, of having the time to concentrate on something.
It's such a deep dive and such a joy to do that, such an intellectual freedom and pursuit. Beautiful. I loved it.
What advice would you give to those who think they're not smart enough to do a PhD, that they don't, that it's not for them, they don't want to stay in an academic path?
Yeah, I'll tell two stories. Well, when I tell all my first two students, I didn't finish high school. I left school when I was 16. And the other thing, this people often say this to me as well, and it gives me the absolute shits, and I'm not particularly tolerant in my response. So they say, oh, I've got every job I've ever gone for. And I go, oh, well, that's all great for you. You're aiming too low. Yep. You're aiming too low. So if you think you're not smart enough, I don't know, don't be too scared about finding out. Just try. Just do it. Just try. What's the worst that's going to happen? You're going to find out what you already knew, that you're not smart enough to do a PhD. Well, big deal.
Yeah.
Then contribute to the world in other ways. But if you think, if you're curious, it does have to come from some curiosity. If you're curious to get questions answered, or for me, my master's research was purely political. If you are keen to really explore something you think is a myth, or you think is an injustice, or you think is, I don't know, just wrong, that's all curiosity too, really, isn't it? I mean, I could have found out, lots of women prefer a cesarean section. I could have found out that the intervention that I thought was shit hot in helping women deal with traumatic birth was a complete and utter waste of time or made them worse. But you've got to have a level of curiosity about finding out things. And I think that comes from values around transparency, accountability, truth-telling. You know, it also comes around values about women-centered care, providing quality maternal and newborn care. So if you think research interests, if you think you want to find out answers to as yet unanswered problems, then research is for you. Mm. Just find a way to participate in it. And you can tell yourself all sorts of negative things along the way or at the beginning, but be bold and carry on. When I first got in to do my diploma in nursing education, I was about 28, and that was my first time to university, and I hadn't finished high school. And between applying and getting in, so I'd been accepted, but I hadn't started yet. I thought, if I could only get pregnant, or if I could break my leg, or any face-saving reason not to go. I really, really hoped for a face-saving reason not to go. But neither of those things happened, and so I went. And then for my very first assignment in educational psychology, I got 1 out of 10. I cried. And the lecturer was beautiful, and she just came up. She could see I was distressed, and it was in the days you hand out papers in class. And she came up to me and she said, "Jenny, you did a really lovely answer to the wrong question."
Yep. Yeah.
Come and see me afterwards. So after I dried my tears, I went and saw her. It was only worth a small percentage, smart teacher, only worth a small percentage of the overall marks. And it was great. I understood assessment criteria. The rest is history. So I don't know. Get over yourself. You don't have to get over the self-doubts. You can carry them along with you. Mm. And just do it anyway. Just do it anyway.
Yeah, the character building times.
Well, you're not going to die.
No.
No sun's still going to go up in the morning. Just do it anyway. You'll soon know if it's a path for you. You'll never know unless you start walking down the path.
This is very true. And even if your results aren't what you expect, negative results are still just as important. It's harder to get published, but it's still important that we talk about those negative results or those unexpected results. And, well, it actually didn't prove anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So it can be a lot of fun. You learn a lot of things. You learn a lot of things about yourself, and you contribute midwifery-led knowledge, midwifery design knowledge to the world. And that is a massive, massive gap in our understanding of maternal and newborn care.
Which hopefully more and more of the midwives and those interested in birthing will actually help fill the gap. Thank you very much for your time.
It's been a great pleasure, Liz. It's an indulgence, really.
It kind of works both ways. You get to talk, I get to listen, other people get to listen, and you never know what it sparks in people in the future.
Yeah, I think it's a great project, Liz. Well done.
Thanks. Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.